think that we can get much higher than this.
You are listening to Can't Get Much Higher, a podcast and newsletter about the intersection of music and data. My name is Christopher Dalariva, and I am your host. So near the end of 2023, country superstar Garth Brooks put out some new music in maybe the strangest way possible. I'll let Rolling Stone magazine explain. Quote, on November 7th, Brooks will release Time Traveler as part of a 7-CD box set that's the third installment of the country superstar's The Limited series. The box set will feature all three of Brooks' post-retirement studio albums, as well as the triple live album Triple Live plus Time Traveler. However, The Limited series is limited exclusively to Bass Pro Shops, the sporting goods store that specializes in fishing gear and the outdoors. End quote. Yes, you heard that correctly. Brooks' latest album was exclusively available at Bass Pro Shops. This seems like an insane release strategy, even for someone who has sold more than 162 million records in the United States. But I actually think that in our hyper-digital age, he was onto something, albeit not in quite the right way. 1948 was a bad year if you owned a big movie studio. First, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the studios in United States versus Paramount Pictures, ending many anti-competitive but lucrative practices around theatrical exhibition and distribution. Second, a new technology was on the rise, television. In their 1994 paper, Household Appliances and the Use of Time, the United States and Britain Since the 1920s, Sue Bowden and Avner Offer estimated that 1% of American households had a television in 1948. 7 years later, 75% did. Up to the point of publication, that was the fastest a piece of domestic technology diffused through the population. That speed of domination created some fear among movie companies, but it also created opportunity. For decades, if you wanted to see a movie that was no longer in theaters, you were out of luck. Television changed that. Now a movie could be played in the theater and then later on TV. Even better, it would make money in both of those scenarios. For example, when CBS negotiated with MGM to air The Wizard of Oz in 1956, 17 years after its theatrical release, they agreed to pay $225,000, or $2.6 million adjusted for inflation, each time they showed it.
Who killed the Witch of the East? Was it you?
No. No, it was an accident. I didn't mean to kill anybody.
As at-home viewing technology emerged, movies could make money for a much longer period. You can see this by imagining various revenue streams for films released in 30-year increments. In the 1930s, you were mostly making money during the theatrical run. But in the 1960s, you had that theatrical run, and then you could make money licensing your film to television networks later. By the 1990s, again, you still had the theatrical run, you could license your film to television networks, but you also could make money via sales and rentals of a VHS. But jump forward 30 more years to get to the 2020s. Suddenly, this model is broken. Maybe you'll release your movie for a short run in theaters, but it will likely be available either simultaneously or shortly after on some streaming service viewers likely already pay for. Most people are not signing up for a new service just to watch one movie. Matt Damon described this changing dynamic more explicitly in a 2022 interview on Hot Ones.
Well, so what happened was the DVD was a huge part of our business, of our revenue stream. And technology has just made that obsolete. And so the movies that we used to make, you could afford to not make all of your money when it played in the theater, because you knew you had the DVD coming behind the release, and 6 months later you'd get all, you know, a whole nother chunk. It would be like reopening the movie almost. And when that went away, that changed the type of movies that we could make. I did this movie Behind the Candelabra, and I talked to a studio executive who explained it was a $25 million movie. I would have to put that much into print and advertising, right, to market it. What we call P&A, so I'd have to put that in P&A. So now I'm in $50 million. I have to split everything I get with the exhibitor, right, the people who own the movie theaters. So I would have to make $100 million before I got into profit. And the idea of making $100 million on a story about, like, this love affair between these two people, yeah, I love everyone in the movie, but that's suddenly a massive gamble in a way that it wasn't in the 1990s when they were making all those kind of movies, the kind of movies that I loved and the kind of movies that were my bread and butter.
While I think Hollywood could benefit from lengthening rather than shortening theatrical release windows, I don't want to talk about that here. I want to talk about how I think the music industry needs to take some cues from Hollywood of the 1990s. As noted, for decades, the movie business model was based on exclusivity or windowing. you could only watch certain movies in certain ways at certain times. This made it possible that viewers would pay multiple times for the same film. The music industry's history with exclusivity has been much smaller in scope. In the 2000s, we saw huge artists do exclusive releases with large corporations like Target and Starbucks in an attempt to stem the bleeding from diminishing CD sales. Then in the 2010s, big artists like Frank Ocean and Kanye West tried to window albums to specific streaming services, while others, like myself, would premiere their music on specific blogs. None of this stuck, though. As I speak to you, Taylor Swift is on the verge of releasing her new album, The Tortured Poets Department. When it comes out, you will not only be able to stream it, but you will be able to hear it on the radio and buy it as a vinyl record, CD, cassette, or digital download. And this has been the general model in music for a long time. Release your music everywhere and all formats all at once. Why did the music industry's business model develop like this instead of like Hollywood's business model? There are a few factors that you could point to, but I think the most important is the Billboard charts. Careers are made and lost on the chart performance of a song or album. Since Billboard accounts for all formats, exclusivity can be the difference between your music premiering at number 1 versus number 41. Furthermore, if an artist tried to first make their music available, say, on CD for 3 months before releasing it to streaming services, it would almost immediately be pirated and uploaded to various sites online. In other words, format-based windowing or exclusivity just won't work in this day and age. That's why I think the industry should get more experimental with experiential exclusivity. Here's an example. Recently, Maggie Rogers put out her understated third record, Don't Forget Me.
My friend Sally's getting married to me, that sounds so scary.
My friend Eddie pointed out to me that 3 days before the record's release, Maggie Rogers tweeted that there would be listening parties at a handful of places in the United States. Rogers did not invent the idea of listening parties, but she got me thinking about how powerful they could be with a little innovation. There are bars all over the world that host trivia, karaoke, and other events to try to get people to visit during off-peak nights. Imagine labels and artists partnered with bars to have nights where new music would be played a few weeks or months before it was released. Also, imagine the bar charged $10 a person and split the revenue with the artists. This scenario has many desirable properties. First, it's cheap for artists and fans. In an age of wildly expensive concert tickets, this would be a low-cost way for fans to experience music socially, while also only requiring an artist to, say, email an MP3 to someone. Second, it's very scalable. Unlike a concert, the artist does not have to be present for something like this, meaning you could scale it to hundreds of locations very easily. Third, it builds hype without hurting sales. Given that this is focused on an experience rather than a purchase, events like this could build hype without eating into sales and hurting chart position. Fourth, it's not that easy to pirate something like this. Sure, you could record what you heard on your phone and upload it online, but it would likely be low quality in a noisy bar and much harder to capture than just, you know, ripping something from a CD and uploading it somewhere. And finally, it supports local businesses. I can't imagine local businesses being upset about an initiative like this if it could get people through their doors during slower nights. Would this be as easy as I'm making it sound? Probably not, but I don't think it's as outlandish as it might sound. In fact, I think it plays well with the superfan experiences that the CEOs of Warner and Universal Music have respectively been touting. Furthermore, I think it builds off of the live music boom that has been ongoing for the last few years. As I've discussed at various times throughout this podcast, the music industry is not perfect. There are issues with music streaming, there are issues with ticketing, there are issues with gender representation. But we can't just wish these issues away. We need to come up with innovative solutions to address them. While I think looking to the musical and cinematic technology of the Clinton administration to solve contemporary problems is often a mistake, sometimes the past can provide a nice blueprint for the future. As always, we recommend a new song and an old song each week. This week's new song comes from Cindy Lee, and it's called Flesh and Blood. If Garth Brooks had the most interesting release strategy of 2023, then Cindy Lee has had the most interesting release strategy this year so far. Lee, the alter ego of Canadian musician Patrick Flagel, made their latest record Diamond Jubilee only available on YouTube in a website that looks like it was straight out of 1997. It's received nothing but rave reviews. I think Pitchfork's rave captures the sound of the album and Flesh and Blood, my favorite track on the album, better than I ever could. Quote, "This may be the greatest radio station you've ever come across, unless it's multiple stations talking over each other, in and out of range. Sounds arrive in strange combinations. Nothing is quite exactly the way you remember. Did that classic rock band really have a synth player? And why did they pick a patch that sounds like a mosquito buzzing through a cheap distortion pedal? And those eerie harmonies swirling at the outskirts of the last dance ballad by some 1960s girl group whose name ends in L's or E's? Did they hire a few heartbroken ghosts who were hanging around the studio as backing vocalists? Or are those fragments of other songs, other signals, surfacing like distant headlights over a hill, then disappearing once more?
Thank you.
The old song this week takes us back to 2014. It's called The Miracle of Joey Ramone by U2. In 2014, U2 put out their new album, Songs of Innocence, in maybe the most annoying way possible. They worked with Apple to automatically give the album to all 500 million users of iTunes. And when I say automatically give, I don't mean you had the option to download it for free. I mean it was added to your iTunes library whether you wanted it there or not. People naturally did not like this, especially since it was very hard to get rid of the album. If you're going to force an album onto everybody's computer, it better be as good as U2's The Joshua Tree. While Songs of Innocence is not that good, I do really enjoy the opening track, The Miracle of Joey Ramone. If you've been avoiding this album out of spite for the last decade, now is the time to give one of the songs a try.
Woke up at the moment when the miracle occurred. Heard a song that made some sense.
And that is your show. My name is Christopher Dalriva. I am the host of Can't Get Much Higher. This is a weekly podcast about the intersection of music and data. Can't Get Much Higher also has a newsletter component. Newsletter subscribers get access to additional content that is not available on the podcast. If you would like to subscribe to the newsletter, just go to the description on your podcast provider, click the link, and you can subscribe. Also in that description, you will find links to playlists that contain all the new songs and old songs that we have recommended. We will be back next week with some more fun. Have a good week.